Well, welcome, everyone. First, please notice that I've passed out these charts, which I found online. I couldn't get it to print in a way that would keep the color coding explanation, so I'll just give it to you verbally. Where you see salmon, that's a king that generally does evil. And so that's why you see God's judgment, you know, did evil. Where you see green, that's did right. Okay? Then when you see yellow, that's kind of like partial credit. This is someone who did pretty well for some things and then not for others. Usually, well, I'll explain that in a minute. The thing that can make also trying to keep track of these kings difficult is they will have different names, sometimes from translation to translation, sometimes within the same translation. So Jehoram will also be called Joram. Ahaziah will also be called Jehoahaz. So you have these, remember, these names are significant, so sometimes you get different names because of the significance in one context or another. But it used to be that if you were an educated person, for example, if you think about something like Jane Austen's Mansfield Park, it starts with Fanny Price, who's not really getting any kind of schooling at all because her parents are sort of poor and are in tough straits, and she's sent to live with her aunt and uncle, the Bertrams, who have the estate, and the daughters are being privately tutored. And at one point, one of the older daughters is, after she's talked to Fanny and just realizes what's going on, she doesn't know the kings of France, she doesn't know the kings of England, because of course, as 10, 11, 12-year-old girls, they had to memorize centuries of kings. They had to memorize English kings, French kings, because that was how you kept track of historical events by the reign of the monarch. There's a lovely reflection by F. Scott Fitzgerald's daughter, Frances, where she was, because they bounced around New York and Paris and so on, she talked about how her father gave her these mnemonic devices for remembering the kings of England. Here's kind of how to keep it straight. Here are your C's and your Edwards and your Richards and so on. Here's this American kid who's kind of being what we would call homeschooled. And an important part of that education is that you remember the kings. So part of the thing for us, I think, if that was sort of our habit of mind, that, history, you have to remember like these lineages, this kind of thing would be easier for us. Because that's how, in a traditional or a monarchical society, that's how they keep track of history, is by the line of the kings. But that's not us. So we are in the section that's in yellow. So Joash, Amaziah, and that's on the Judah side, and then Jehu over on the Israel side. Okay, that's kind of where we're at. And you'll notice these are yellow. These are partial credit people, and why? Because remember, they're kind of stages to the decadence in Israel. If we go way back to the beginning, opening of the kings, before the temple is built, there are these high places where worship is happening that it's not supposed to be happening. And it could be these are high places where kind of their heart's in the right place. They actually are trying to worship the right God, but they're not doing it the right way. They're not doing it according to the Deuteronomic code. But then you're going to have people who are worshiping the high places that they actually are carrying out forms of idolatry. after the temple is built, then there's a second stage of this rebellion. So when Jeroboam, breaks off the 10 tribes of Israel from the temple, from the palace, from Rehoboam, Solomon's son. And he sets up kind of these golden calves. But again, the idea is we're worshiping the true God, but we're worshiping up here because we don't want to send people down to Jerusalem and, have them acknowledge the king of Judah, as they're thinking of that at that point. And then the kind of the third or lowest state, which is what's happening in both, especially in Israel, but to some degree also then in Jerusalem, Baal worship, where you are, this is now the bottom. You are worshiping the Canaanite gods. You are worshiping Baal and Moloch and Ashtoreth. These are things that it could involve child sacrifice. This is kind of the low point. So these folks who are getting partial credit, these are people who are raising up the people from at least Baal worship. They're tearing down the statues of Baal or waging war on the Baal worshippers. So, okay, 70%. You know, you're doing something that's worth recognition and commendation. But for a number of these kings, they aren't willing to make the additional step of suppressing, for example, the high places. That's something we'll see in a couple of spots. Or in suppressing the center of worship in Israel away from Jerusalem. In other words, they're not leading people back to the temple. Especially if you're a king of Israel, you're on this side. On this side here. You don't want to lead people back to the temple because that takes away your political power. Remember, when you read about Solomon, the temple and the palace are in a way united. Whereas if you've broken off in Israel and you've got this separate center of rule, you've got to have a separate center of worship. So that's why they are only willing to go so far. Let's start by looking at going back to First Book of Kings and chapter 19 in the First Book of Kings. At the time, I think we talked about Elijah's kind of way of life, that he lives in a way a contemplative or almost kind of monastic way of life. And there's this scene, this is a scene very often that you'll hear in church in the readings, when he crosses the desert. Remember, he's fed, this angel gives him food, and then he lives on the strength of that food for 40 days and 40 nights. Right? Again, one of these figures of Lent. He comes across the desert to Mount Horeb, and he's in this cave in Mount Horeb, and if you recall, he's supposed to listen for the Lord. There's an earthquake, there's a wind, there are all these things that are very dramatic. No, the Lord is not in those things. And then finally, there's a small voice, and that's when Elijah goes out. And what he is told here is he's given these prophecies of what is going to happen. So if you look at 14 to 18, I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, throw down your altars, slain your prophets with a sword, and I am left, and they seek my life to take it away. Okay, this is Elijah's pleading to God. And the Lord said to him, go, return your way to the wilderness of Damascus. When you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria, and Jehu to be son of Nimshi, you will appoint to be king over Israel, and Elisha, son of Shaphat, of Belmonala. Just say it with confidence. Belmahola. you shall anoint to be prophet in your place. Okay? And then there are these prophecies that are made about Hazael and Jehu, that he who escapes from the sword of Hazael shall Jehu slay, and him that escapes from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha slay. Yea, I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. Okay. Now, by the way, this is I think what at the time we talked about this, this was a text that I pointed out that, remember, Elijah at this point is sort of in despair. He really has the sense that nobody in Israel believes anymore. You know, that this is over. But God reassures him, you are going to anoint these people. There's going to be a judgment on the worshipers of Baal. And I have reserved to myself 7,000 who have not bowed their knees to Baal. In other words, even when things just look awful, there's always a remnant. Right, there is always a remnant, and in fact, when Newman will talk about the line from Matthew, you know, many are called but few are chosen. This is one of the verses that I'll comment on, that if you look at Israel as a whole, it doesn't look like sort of like they're all being saved or many of them are being saved. And the message of God here is that there's this remnant that he saved for himself. So even among God's people, there's apostasy, there's rebellion. And yet, there is always this remnant. There's always this group that, in cooperation with God's grace, have remained loyal. This is where you first hear about the people that we're talking about today, Hazael and Jehu. Okay? And you're told that Elijah is supposed to anoint them, and we're hearing about them for the first time. Elijah's already, right? He's already taken his flight into heaven. So the understanding is, you're not doing this yourself, but the person that you anoint will do this, right? So Elisha is actually the one who deals with these two people, right? It's not Elijah himself. But Elijah gets the message that this is going to happen. Okay, over the weekend I was rereading a book of William Henry Green. He was a Bible scholar at Princeton. This was back in the days in the late 1800s when Princeton was very seriously Presbyterian. For many of you, you may just think of Princeton as this kind of secular elite, Ivy League school. But remember, this used to be a Presbyterian seminary. And in that turn of the century, end of the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s, they had a couple of really world-class scholars who were criticizing what they were seeing as this trend in Bible scholarship, this sort of gradual sucking the supernatural characteristics of Revelation out of the book. And Green, in this book, it's called The Higher Criticism of the Pentateuch. And it's a slim little thing. It's about 170 pages. But after kind of surveying the field, he gets to the end of it and he says, the strategy for many of these Bible commentators is they take passages which appear prophetic, and then, through things in the history or things in the text, they try to make it look as though it's not really prophetic, that this is something that the writer sort of already knows about, and he's kind of just inserting in there to kind of make it look like it's something prophetic. And then the accumulated instances of that either create the impression or support the statement that really there's no prophecy in the Bible. But he said the fact is these are interpreters who have gone into the book with that understanding. They're not really proving it from the instances. That's in a way what they believed before they opened the book. Okay? And I'm reminded of it here. One of the books that we're looking at for next year is Isaiah. And one of the folks in out of this Princeton school, Oswald Alice, has this wonderful book on Isaiah. And the main thesis that he's arguing is that this really is a prophetic book, that this really is a book in which the writer is having a vision of things that are yet to come. And he's responding. This book on Isaiah, this is, I want to say, from like 1930s. He's writing against the scholarship on Isaiah, which all assumes that it is written after the events have happened. Right? That's where all the mainstream Bible scholarship is. That in fact the book is not prophetic at all. Somehow somebody at the time is sort of projecting back these prophecies. And in fact they even date the book that way. They even say, well, it's not possible that the book could have been written because none of the stuff had happened yet. Right? That's kind of the argument. So let's take a look at each of them. Hazael is, if you remember, he is coming on a mission from the king of Syria. The king of Syria is sick. He wants to know if he's going to live. And so he sends Hazael to Elisha to find out. And Elisha tells him two things. Well, the king is going to live, but he's not going to live very long because you're going to kill him. And Hazael is somebody who he's shocked, he's embarrassed that this would be the prophecy. But then he goes and makes it happen. Okay? And in fact, it's even described in the book how he kills him, that this guy is feverish. He takes the cloth that you use to kind of bring the fever down and suffocates him with the cloth. Okay, so he suffocates him. And the fact that he's alone with the king and in a position to do this, this is somebody who's trusted. You know, he's Ben-Hadad has trusted him with this mission, sent him off. So this is someone who's close to him, and he takes advantage of that. Now you'll notice the thing that I have here about prophecy and free will. Does Hazael hear that he's not going to live and assume that this is like permission? Okay? And you know, commentators make very clear it's not. And in fact it's clear that Elisha isn't giving him permission. You know, in fact, he's deploring, this is what you're going to do. Okay? So there are people who sort of excuse themselves based on what they feel as though, well, this is fated to be. This is just the way things are going. This is just the way things are headed. And obviously one of the implications in this text is, no, this is what he is choosing to do. What the prophet, the reason the prophet tells him this is not to sort of give him an idea. This is, you know, if you read about someone like a Padre Pio in the confessional, he's reading hearts. He is reading what is in Hazael's hearts and trying to get him to change. So if you think about, fast forward to the New Testament, when Jesus says to Judas, what you are about to do, do quickly. Okay? Does Jesus walk away? I've been given permission, right? I've been given my pass. No, that really is a kind of a last call to have remorse for the choice that you're making. You know, it's the Son of Man must be betrayed, but woe to the man who betrays him. Okay, you can never excuse yourself based on sort of what you perceive to be fate or what you perceive to be the way things are going. No, this is a choice. There's a wonderful passage in an encyclical of John Paul II's Familiaris Consortio on the family, where he talks about how it is that people look at history as if it were just a kind of series of inevitable events. Like, you know, history has a certain direction, and you figure out what that direction is, and, you know, each era has a kind of its own mindset and direction. And the Pope on that passage says, you know, history is really an accumulation of free choice. It's what people are choosing to do. So if you look at an era and you look, or you look at a culture and you say, well, this is sort of what they were almost bound to do because of, you know, who they were and when they lived. No, you're ignoring the fact that they are human and they choose. By the way, more and more, of course, that's how we look at bad behavior. No, he grew up poor, that's why he did that. Or he grew up in this kind of neighborhood, that's why he did that. Ignoring all the other people in that neighborhood or all the other people who are lower income who are not making those kind of choices. No, ultimately it's a choice that you're making. Hazael, by the way, I think it says, as it says in the book, it's a name that means seen by God, that you are seen by God. So there's this kind of a significance in the name. You know, God sees you. You know, you have this plan, you're going to carry this out, God sees you. Now, you are told, though, that he is anointed. You're told that God has sort of singled him out, because even though Hazael is choosing something evil, there's he can still fit in with God's plan. Again, like Judas. Judas does something that is evil, but there is a way in which God's plan is affected, you know, through Judas's choice. It doesn't mean that the choice is good, but it means that God brings good out of evil. Jehu, if you remember, this is the fellow who's anointed. He's anointed by Elisha. Elisha wants to send somebody to see him privately, anoint him. And then everybody wants to, what was that? Oh, you know, that crazy guy. He just sent somebody to talk to me. Don't take it seriously. But the army, his captains, whatnot, they won't listen. okay, he anointed me. There, you have it. No sooner do they have that than they are spreading cloaks before him. Okay? So again, that's supposed to call to mind, remember when Jesus comes into Jerusalem, right? What are they doing? They're spreading palm leaves. You know, his feet aren't supposed to touch the ground. So Jehu, who is under the king, right? He's one of the army servants. He leads a rebellion, and that rebellion is successful. There's a probably out of his kingship, the thing that gets the most attention is how it is that he deals with these worshipers of Baal. Because remember, what he does is he says, let's set up a big Baal festival. We'll invite everybody. We'll set up the statues for Baal. And of course, you know, all these folks come and they think that he's on their side. And then he kills them all. I mean, slaughter would be a better term, right? He slaughters them all, okay? And you're already set up that this is the way he's going to act from the way that he's treated the king's relatives. Remember, he kills all of Ahab's relatives as well. Is that deception that he gives, is that morally allowable? You know, in other words, can you trick the followers of Baal to gather them all in one place so that you can execute them? So in St. Thomas, he will raise this thing as an objection, drawing from, I think this is St. Jerome, and what the question is, are you allowed to use, you know, are you allowed to lie and use dissimulation and whatnot? Okay? No sin is profitable, but according to Jerome in his commentary in Galatians, the example of Jehu, king of Israel, who slew the priest of Baal, pretending that he desired to worship idols, should teach us that dissimulation is useful and sometimes to be employed. Okay? So in other words, can't you use this as an example of, you know, deception being a good thing? And it's interesting when St. Thomas responds, St. Jerome says this, but he uses the word simulation broadly for any kind of pretense. Okay, David is somebody that comes up. There is no need to excuse Jehu's dissimulation from sin or lie, because he was a wicked man. And since he departed not from the idolatry of Jeroboam, and yet he is praised and receives an earthly reward from God, not for his dissimulation, but for his zeal in destroying the worship of Baal. Anyway, I used the term earlier, partial credit. So on the whole, you know, the judgment of Scripture against Jehu is, this is not somebody who's good, but he is somebody who does a good thing. These Baal worshippers do need to be punished, and he punishes them. But does that by itself sort of make him a good man? No. Yeah, go ahead.
Does that get at also that question around, do the ends justify the means?
It does.
So what would be the response to that?
Well, it's funny, because just a couple of weeks ago, we were talking in moral theology about the opening of the book of Exodus. So probably you remember the Moses part, but that starts in the second chapter. In the first chapter, it starts with Pharaoh noticing, of course, that the Hebrew people are multiplying. There are more and more and more of them. And so he tells these two Egyptian midwives, when you deliver the Hebrew babies, if it's a boy, kill it. You know, if it's a girl, let it live. And it's funny, when you do that, of course, with teenagers, they don't really understand child delivery or any of that, you know. So you tell them, how are you going to kill these kids? And one of them said, throw it in the river. I said, okay, how much more longer are you going to get called in as a midwife if you start throwing babies in the river? I mean, when you're there on Angie's list, he threw my baby, one star. I will never get this midwife again. No, they're when a baby's delivered, there's all sorts of ways in which it's very vulnerable. When the baby's coming out, there are all sorts of ways in which it's very vulnerable. There are ways to make it look like an accident. But you're told in the text, these midwives feared God, and they wouldn't do this. And so Pharaoh calls them in again and says, hey, you're not doing what I told you to do. And now they fib. They say, the Hebrew women are not as our women. The babies are delivered by the time we get there. You know, they don't seem to need midwives. They just have babies. And it's at that point that Pharaoh resorts to now having to do something openly. And he tells the soldiers, take the male babies and throw them in the river. Okay, and the female, if they're female babies, let them live. And of course, the very next chapter is now Moses. Now, in that chapter, St. Thomas will use that as an objection about whether lying is bad in itself. And I'll say, well, these midwives, they lie. They lie to kind of cover up what they've been doing. And you're told later that God blessed them and built them houses. Some translations will say built them houses. What that means, as you'll see in other translations, gave them families. They got married. They had families of their own. They prospered. So isn't God kind of rewarding them, you know, for fibbing? And in the response, what he will say is, if you look at the text, they are getting rewarded because they feared God. In other words, because they saved the babies. They are not, however, getting rewarded for telling a lie. That, if anything, that's being, if you like, pardoned or overlooked or forgiven. So the lying part is still bad. They're getting credit, though, because they feared God and they refused to kill the babies.
But couldn't you argue that then that the ends would justify the means because you would be pardoned in the end anyway? So,
well, if you went into it with that understanding, then that would be you're essentially saying that one can do evil, you know, for a good result. So no, I mean, if you went into it with the idea that I am knowingly choosing evil with the sake of being forgiven, that's the thing that actually blocks you from being forgiven. When you look at, maybe I need to just say briefly, when St. Thomas talks about lying being intrinsically wrong, you know, first, what's on his side is that when you look at the Old Testament, when you try this sometime, put in a search window, put in lying, liar, lies, just, you know, do it in any translation you like. Every hit you get back is going to be condemning. Every hit you get back is going to be the Lord hates lying lips. The Lord hates deceit. A lying tongue is detested. That's all you get. And the narrative with these midwives, in terms of a character that is a good character that tells a lie and gets away with it, that's about the midwives in that narrative are about as good as it gets. Because most of the times where you have lying, you have it by somebody who is clearly bad. Or you have a character who lies, but the focus is not on the lying. The focus is on some sort of mystery it's fulfilling. What do I mean? So think about Jacob and Esau. When, you know, Jacob flat out lies. He covers himself with hairy skins and says, feel me, I am your son Esau. And even dad, you know, the skin is the skin of Esau, but the voice is the voice of Jacob. When someone like Augustine will take that passage, he will say that the deception signifies, you know, things that are in the New Testament or signifies mystery. He does not try to defend Jacob lying to his father about who he is. Okay. In fact, let's take that, the end justifying the means. This, when Augustine talks about this particular passage, he has a fairly long, I'm not going to read the whole thing to you, but he said, if it really were the case that you could lie, for example, to save life, let's use the extreme, then what sense do you make of the martyrs in the early church? You know, why couldn't these people have just said, I'm not really Christian, or I'll sacrifice to the emperor, or I'll sacrifice to the gods? In other words, if you can lie to save your life, then why couldn't people in the early church lie to avoid martyrdom? Okay? As Augustine, and in fact, it's specifically in this discussion of Jehu. Jehu falsely gives himself out as a servant of Baal that he might slay Baal's servants. How much more justly, according to their view, in a time of persecution, the servants of Christ falsely give themselves out for servants of demons, that the servants of demons might not slay the servants of Christ and sacrifice to idols that men might not be killed. Right? In fact, he uses this specific example If this is sort of morally allowable, then why wouldn't people be allowed to lie to escape martyrdom? Okay, and in fact, that was one of the things as we got into the discussion in class. I shared with them this passage out of the book of the Maccabees. So it's 2 Maccabees, chapter 7. It's where this woman is watching one by one her children being slain because they refuse to either worship the emperor or eat pork. Right? They won't transgress the law. And finally, the tyrant gets to the point, this Greek invader, where he says to the woman, you only got one son left. You know, tell him to give up the faith so that, you know, and I'll let him live. And she goes to her son and in her own language tells her, you know, I didn't make you. God made you in my womb. You know, God is the one who created heaven and earth. Don't give up the faith. Look on all of this that God has made and remember that I bore you. And, you know, she's encouraging him against this guy. Now, that's the kind of thing that I think you can't make sense of if you have the point of view that survival is the highest good. You know, they, usually when you get an ends justify the means, the payoff is usually survival. And since we've read the letter from a Birmingham jail, one of the things I point out to students is if your idea is survival is the highest good, what sense do you make of people who risked their lives during the civil rights movement? You know, I mean, there were people who disappeared in the swamps of Mississippi. We never saw them again. But they did that because they thought that life was not the highest good. That there was this way of life that they were willing to die for, and I think that the reason that lying, you know, keeps coming up is I think in our society, I think there's a kind of a greater acceptance of lying, or it's sort of not as important. You know, it's just not, to put it in kid language, it's just not that big a deal. But when you look at, again, the Old Testament, New Testament, think about Peter weeping bitterly that he lied to save his life when he's arrested. When you look at the illustrations of the Tao, like in the back of Lewis, all of these different cultures, when they talk about lying, they just speak in blanket terms like it's wrong. They just use, you know, be not willing to tell any manner of lie, right? That's Egyptian, it's Babylonian, you know, and so on. I don't know if you had something.
Well, another example that came up was during Nazi Germany.
And again, my students bring up that one too.
What
scenario are you thinking of? Are you thinking that they're really going, do you have any Jews? No. Next door. Do you have any Jews? No. Like it's the Kirby vacuum cleaner guy just sort of coming door to door? If they are convinced that you have Jews, they're searching your house no matter what you say. You're not going to put them off with a simple yes or no. You're not going to put them off that way. Now, are you somehow required? I mean, just to be clear, are you somehow required? Okay, you got me. I got 14 Jews in the attic. I got 12 in the basement. No, they don't have a right, you know, to know those things. You know, you don't tell them things when they're doing things that are unjust. Certainly, what you're allowed to do if it's an unjust authority is to deceive them. You can say things like, "Do I look like the kind of guy that would hide Jews?" You know, you can do things like that.
Clever.
Well, I mean, no more clever than lying. You know, after teaching teenagers for 13 years, I assure you that they are quite clever when it comes to lying. Yeah. Well, lying isn't something that demands any more clever, you know, any less cleverness than deception. But the idea is the falsehood that's in their mind, they have it in their mind because you said it? Or is it in their mind because they came to the wrong conclusion, right? So when you read Lives of the Saints, for example, someone like St. Athanasius, if you've never read A Life of St. Athanasius, it's a rollicking good tale. You know, he gets kicked out of his diocese 5 different times by the emperor because he didn't want all this arguing over Jesus Christ being truly God and truly man. He just wanted, you know, peace and stability. Anyway, they're chasing after him. He's going up the Nile River. And he's about 3 miles or so ahead of the emperor's men. They're going up the river together. They don't quite know what he looks like. You know what I mean? They don't have like a wanted poster or something like that that they can compare. So there he is going up the river. And at a certain point, Athanasius realizes they're going to catch up to me. So he turns his boat around and heads in their direction. So there they are. There's the emperor's men. There's his boat. And they pass each other. And they shout at him, "Have you seen Athanasius the bishop?" And he shouts back, "I don't think he's far away." Okay. When you read Lives of the Saints, that's the kind of thing you see. You know, when you read Lives of the Saints, they do everything they can not to lie. You know, they do everything they can not to lie. They will say things that are ambiguous. They will say things that are misleading. But they really do have they really do put a premium on the truth. They really do put a premium on the truth. And again, at the point where you're allowed to lie to save life, it's hard to see why that wouldn't apply to the martyrs. That's kind of the first, when you read the fathers and lying comes up as an issue, that's almost the first thing that comes up. You know, because Peter lies to save his life. And he doesn't say, "Well, you know, I felt bad about it, but, you know, you got to do what you got to do." No, he goes out and weeps bitterly that he lied. You know, that it again, it's hard to find biblical examples that would provide a ground for support. Let's talk a little bit about Jezreel before we conclude. We are seeing justice and vindication. Remember in 1 Kings, one of the things that, because there's a whole chapter dedicated to it, the taking of Naboth's vineyard. That Naboth has this vineyard, Ahab wants it, he asks him for it, he offers to buy it. Naboth says, "No, how could I do such a thing?" Right? Remember, land is what establishes your family and gives your family wealth. You know, without land, you're nothing. But Naboth's scheming wife, Jezebel, talks him into basically framing him for blasphemy and adultery. Not adultery, sorry, blasphemy. Blasphemy and heresy. And then they take the vineyard. Okay? And this happens in Jezreel. Okay? And remember, the prophecy about Bathsheba is that she's going to die at the same place. And that's what happens at the end of 9. And this is a word that I learned from Dr. Carpenter. So here's a little homage to Dr. Carpenter. Defenestration. Because there's this famous historical event, the defenestration of Prague. I guess there were these representatives of the emperor that they were thrown out the window by one of the European kings. And so that's what happens to Jezebel. She's defenestrated. All Jehu needs to do is, "Hey, is there nobody that thinks that this woman is a problem?" And there are, in fact, lots of people who are willing to sign up for that. One of the things that you're told, by the way, she puts on her makeup. And when you first read that, you think, is she dolling herself up? But in some of the commentaries that I read around in she's not trying to look pretty. She's trying to look fierce. In other words, she's going out in kind of her regal appearance. "I am going to go out there and draw myself to my full height and try to use the intimidation factor." And Jehu is not intimidated. And he gets someone to throw her out the window. He's actually willing to bury her, but then the prophecy comes true. All they find is her hands and her, what is it? Yeah, they find her extremities. And again, I found a note that those are the parts that dogs don't eat. First of all, it's just disturbing that dogs will eat people or eat corpses, but that, well, there are certain parts they eat and certain parts they don't. So that's what they leave behind. So again, the prophecy of her fall and punishment, here it is. And it happens in this same spot at the scene of the crime. Yeah, go ahead.
The other thing is, dogs in that culture are regarded as kind of just slightly above pigs.
Yes.
Okay, one. Two, in Judaism, if the whole body is not buried together, the probability of that person going to heaven is kind of questionable.
Yep.
It has to be. That's why in the Passion of the Christ, you see Mary wiping the blood.
Wiping the blood.
Parts of the body that she understands needs to be buried with them. Even in Israel, if a bomb goes off, they're searching diligently for...
to find the parts of the body, yep.
Parts. And so for her to not be able to be buried, be eaten by a dog, and for the hand is the considered the thing that you do good works with,
yep,
in Judaism, So all of that is like a, it's like a double, triple, quadruple this on her, and it's literally pointing out God's complete, utter wrath with her.
This reminds me of in St. Augustine's City of God. At the end of the book, he's talking about the resurrection of the body. And one of the issues he raises is what happens when you have people who are, you know, burned or chopped up or mutilated. And I know for us, generally the modern reader, you already have in mind this omnipotent God. So you just think, what difference does it make? It doesn't matter whether you put it in ashes and scatter it on the sea. If you've got an all-powerful God, he's gonna pull it together. But if your mindset is, no, this body has to kind of be all together or mostly together to be raised, you can feel the force of the objection. And throughout the ancient world, not just in Judaism, but not just among the Jewish people, when you really wanted to stick it to your enemy, you outraged the body. So think about the whole drama of Antigone, where the king does not want the body buried. He wants it left out for the, you know, for the birds and dogs to pick at. In fact, that's the opening of the Iliad, that you have these bodies that are out there that are being picked at by the birds and the dogs. Okay? That's something that's going to, you know, impact your afterlife. This is where the sons of Ahab, these relatives of Ahab, they are all killed, and remember their heads are delivered in a basket. You know, delivered in a basket, right, to this point. So the retribution that was predicted all the way back with Elijah, now it's coming to fruition. Real quick, just on the understanding and just some of the questions here. One of the questions I flagged, you have the chapter on the death of Elisha, and there's this body that's healed, that's put down in the pit with him. If you haven't read this before, there's this body that's put, and it's raised to life. So the book, your workbook there, will raise the question about relics. Okay, and I thought that'd be a good question to talk about, because that's one of the things that Newman raises, you know, coming from the Protestant world and being Protestant for very long. The idea of relics is something that's really uncomfortable for him. But he said, the more that I looked back on the Bible, the more that I realized there are already things which are working as relics, you know, in this book. So I thought that might be good for a conversation. Notice the reading is 13, 14, 15. When we have three questions, I just give you two chapters, so I just gave you 13 and 15. Very good. Next time, 13 through 15.